Have you ever wondered how civilizations are formed? Of course, in school, we study the great civilizations in the past and the artifacts that they left behind. The Egyptians and their pyramids, Rome and the Colosseum, the Mayans and their religious temples. These civilizations have come and gone, but what led to their decline? Hi, I'm Richard Nelson, host of The Commonwealth Matters. The question we're going to tackle on today's program is, what is our civilization moment in the West? Joining us to talk further is John Stonestreet, the president of the Colson Center. He's also the daily voice of the nationally syndicated Breakpoint Commentary. His group and Focus on the Family recently launched a documentary called Truth Rising. It's an assessment of our civilizational moment, how we're losing our civilization, and how it can be restored. John, welcome to The Commonwealth Matters.
Hey, thanks so much. It's great to be on again.
Hey, I had a chance to watch this documentary, and honestly, I was probably going to skip through and hit some of the high points. I appreciate the media kit that was sent out, but after watching the first couple of minutes, I was drawn into it and did watch the whole thing. It was very well done, very moving and persuasive as to the cultural moment that that we are in right now. And Oz Guinness is the one who begins the program, and he brings perspective that most people don't have because he is he's in his 80s. Oz Guinness, of course, is a great Christian thinker, author, but his perspective is that he was born in China. His parents were missionaries, and he lived through the Chinese Communist Revolution. And Guinness says that we are in a civilizational moment in the West. And he says essentially that the animating force and ideas that shaped our civilization are no longer at work. And the choices he sets before us are either to renew, replace, or we go into decline. Now, later in the documentary, John, you add that the solutions that are facing us, and I think all of us can agree here, it doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum or where you are with your religious convictions, most agree that our civilization is in deep, deep trouble. But you go on to say that the solution is not economic, nor is it political, which I think what's left, right? The spiritual. And that cannot be legislated. Our problems cannot be fixed with a check. Just a little side note here, in Kentucky, we are suffering from a drug crisis, and the state legislature and our federal delegation is constantly talking about programs and money that's going to fight the drug epidemic. Last year in Kentucky, we had about 1,600 overdose deaths. Wow. 1,600 people died in the Commonwealth. Tragic. I'm glad that people are working to try to solve the problem. But what's being missed is that there is a spiritual crisis for young people, especially to turn to drugs and to be that hopeless in many cases, to and then unfortunately to lose their lives. But John, my question specifically, since our problems cannot be fixed with a check or any legislation, I think we can agree, you and I can agree that we've got a spiritual crisis here. But my question to you is, where does the church fit mm-hmm. into this civilizational moment?
Yeah. Well, listen, I don't want to imply either by the documentary and my comments in it, or even I think the example of the opioid crisis that's affected so much of middle America for the last, decade and more is a great example of this. You need laws to hold back evil. What laws can't do is restore. You need laws to protect the innocent. You need laws to, if a culture has gone into an evil direction, and in many ways, I think we can look at Western culture and say that we've called wrong right and right wrong, as the scripture says, that laws can actually at least detach us from things that are obviously harmful and wrong and deceptive and so on. But the reattachment to truth, the reanimation of a society, of a civilization, has to happen from the inside out, not the top down. And it happens first within the human heart, and then it happens within communities that are committed to orienting ourselves as citizens, as families, as churches, and so on, to that which is true and what is good. I mean, your comment earlier about, you know, the artifacts of past civilizations, it makes you think, you know, when people look through the artifacts of Western civilization 100 or 1,000 years from now, are they going to actually be able to ascertain clearly the things that made the West what it was? I don't think that that's the case. You know, we're going to probably find computers and cell phones and things like that. But what gave the Western world, the influence that it's had, the flourishing that it's had, has really been ideas, ideas about truth, ideas about God, ideas about morality, certainly ideas about what gives individuals value and dignity in and of themselves. These are ideas that are directly connected to the Judeo-Christian influence on Western culture. You don't find these things around the world. You don't find, for example, a view of universal dignity. You don't find this understanding about what it means to learn and know, and how that really sparked the movement that's distinct to Western culture of universal education and things like that. These are distinctives, and they come from specific places. And what Oz Guinness talks about in the first part of Truth Rising, and he's such a great tour guide, both because of his own personal story and because he's kind of a Gandalf, right, of our world. But what he talks about is that when a civilization is severed, cut off, like a cut flower from those things that animated it, those are the choices that are ahead. You either renew that civilization by reattaching to those ideas, or you face decline. And that's the most common, I think, result in history. Or revolution. Revolution almost never goes well. And one of the surprising, powerful parts of the film for me was Oz talking about that revolutionary possibility and what he had seen in his first 10 years of life in China, yeah. You know, where there that civilization was cut off from its roots and was subject to revolution. And revolution almost always brings bloodshed in a way that is unacceptable. You have very, very few examples of revolutions that make things better, not worse. You have a few, but very, very few. Yeah. And I think that that's really what we wanted to do with this film, is kind of provide that you are here moment. We think about civilizations as things of the past. We don't think of ourselves as kind of belonging to one. And if we are, we kind of feel as if it's inevitable, or as if whatever is driving the Western world is beyond our control. Like there's nothing we can do about it. We're kind of innocent victims of the forces of history. But that's not how the Bible describes what it means to be human. That's not how Western culture has understood the power of human dignity to shape a civilization and to give us the kind of choice that we actually have to be responsible actors in history. And all of this brings us to the critical question of the film, is what kind of people do we need to be at this critical moment?
Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. Have you found yourself frustrated and angry about the direction of the country? Maybe you're watching Fox News and you see what's happening in Congress or in other parts of the country. Let me encourage you to turn your frustration and energy into a positive direction. Have you considered running for local office? And listen to me for a minute. You can have a greater impact on local elections and on policy decisions if you serve in local government. School board, for example, they set curriculum decisions and tax policy. How about city council or fiscal court? These are very important elected offices where you can have a positive impact on. Consider running for local office. CPC is bringing candidate training events all across the state, and we'd love for you to join. If you've ever felt called to run or interested in running, come on and join us. You can find out more information at the Commonwealth Policy website at commonwealthpolicycenter.org. Go ahead and check it out, and we hope to see you in the fall.
John, we saw in the documentary where when a society loses that shared idea of truth, that there is truth, and then they move on to the idea that, well, I can define my own truth to the extent where I'm really a woman trapped in a man's body. And I think of Seth Dillon in the Babylon Bee, where they, of course, the Babylon Bee is satire. And they had commented when the USA Today declared Rachel Levin, who was a transgender male to female, was declared Woman of the Year by USA Today.
Yeah.
And Babylon Bee just, they satirized it, and essentially said, well, Babylon Bee declared him the Man of the Year. And for that, they were blocked out of their Twitter account. So truth and the embrace of truth and reality as it's objectively understood, when we lose that, and when we begin to define our own, what we think reality is, and then begin to impose it on others, it has a huge effect on all of us. And we're seeing this today. In your state of Colorado, just recently, the legislature enacted some kind of law that said that businesses cannot discriminate based on somebody's gender identity. And if they refuse to use the preferred gender pronouns, that business could be punished. There's a lawsuit over this now. So denial of truth has consequences. And when truth is malformed or deformed, and when society is forced to rally around or to somehow get on board with this idea that truth is self-defined, there are consequences, particularly for Christians, not just Christians, other people of other faiths are likely to have their consciences steamrolled or to be coerced to go along with it. John, can you speak? And this is right in the crosshairs for believers, those who want to live by biblical convictions, those who want to live publicly according to those biblical convictions. And this is a moment for the church to respond to.
Well, it is. I mean, listen, ideas have consequences and bad ideas have victims. And some of the victims of our bad ideas are the unraveling of our societies, the things that we count on and rely on and often take for granted. And that's really kind of where we're at in the film. And then the question is, you know, how should we live? You know, the story of Seth Dillon and Truth Rising is one of five stories that we tell. And really what we were trying to do is really in the tradition of Chuck Colson, who wrote the book, How Now Shall We Live, you know, trying to help Christians understand the cultural moment and what their responsibility to truth is. And even Francis Schaeffer, if you remember that name, you know, a generation before, talking about these new ideas that were being introduced, especially in the academy and in the arts, into Western culture and how they were going to do great damage. And both of those men predicted in many ways the kind of truth crisis that we face today. And they both talked about that Christians needed to commit themselves to the truth and be people of truth. Mm-hmm. And what we wanted to do in Truth Rising was to tell five stories of people who exemplify that, who exemplify what it means in an age of deception and an age where we've tried to untether ourselves from God and what is true, to stand for truth, even if it means admitting in at least a couple of the stories that they were fundamentally wrong. I love the Babylon Bee story for a number of reasons. I love it because I too share that spiritual gift of sarcasm, but also because, you know, they didn't know. They took they made a decision to stand for what is true, even though it negatively impacted their company. You know, Twitter at the time was an incredible part of their business model, and they had no idea what the results would be. And not only were the results the fact that, you know, as he jokes in the film, the world's richest man bailed them out of Twitter jail, which of course is part of that story. I don't want to give away too much. Many people know the story, but it's worth hearing from that perspective. But if you think about all the cultural ramifications after that, at a time when cancel culture seemed to be almost unstoppable, in how many ways that decision led to one thing after another, like a domino effect, that really loosened the hold of cancel culture on our society. I mean, that's an amazing thing. They didn't know that. And that's the thing. Soren Kierkegaard said, you have to live life forward and you only understand it backwards. We can turn around and understand it backwards and be really grateful. But what it took was that courageous decision. Another story is Jack Phillips. Jack, of course, the baker in Denver, Colorado, whose decision not to be forced to say something he didn't believe in led to a 13-year attack from the state of Colorado, either from the Civil Rights Commission, from state prosecutors, or the state actually allowing and enabling another private citizen to just relentlessly go after Jack. I think about that a lot because I remember being on my front porch reading the newspaper. I don't know if you remember those, but these were like these papers that had words on them and they would tell stories of the day.
Yes,
I know we basically look at our phones these days, but this was an actual newspaper on my front porch and there was a story there, you know, Denver baker refuses to bake cake for same-sex wedding. And two things immediately came to my mind. The first was, we don't have same-sex weddings in Colorado. I mean, this was before Obergefell. We didn't have them, literally. Like, they didn't exist. The state was one of the 30 states across the United States to define marriage as between a man and a woman. And then, of course, Obergefell came a couple years later and just forced it on the Obergefell decision from the Supreme Court, is what I mean, and forced it on the United States. Well, you know, that was the first thing I thought, is how could it be in trouble for something that doesn't exist? And the second thing I thought was, but he's really in trouble, man. He's going to get it. Mm-hmm. And I think about that a lot now because I think, you know, how important Jack Phillips' story has become to preserving speech rights, to protecting religious organizations and individuals from harassment from the state. That was the big outcome of the first Supreme Court case, the Obergefell, the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. And I think if Jack had just baked that cake, he would have quietly gone into, you know, the next phase, wouldn't have made a bit of difference. No one would have ever known his name. Nothing would have happened. And he could have done that, and he wouldn't have been considered really a bad guy for having done it by most people. Most people would have never known. But he took a stand for truth, not knowing how God was going to use this, not only to protect these rights, but the other cool part of this story is there's an awful lot of people that have come to faith in Jesus Christ, seeing his stand. And that's an amazing thing where you do the right thing and you leave the results up to God. What we wanted to do is start this conversation in Truth Rising with a civilizational moment. Remember, as Oz Guinness says so well in the middle of the film telling his own stories, that we're called to particular times and places, you know, what he calls the hour, knowing the hour in that great English accent that he has. And then saying, what kind of people do we need to be? Well, Jack Phillips is the kind of person we need to be. Seth Dillon's courageous decision might be the kind of decision we need to make. I think about Chloe Cole, another story that's told in the film. Chloe is proof bad ideas have victims. She was a victim of one of the worst ideas of recent memory, that we can be born in the wrong body. It was an idea that specifically was damaging for preteen and teenage girls. She was swept under that, believed it. Double mastectomy at age 16. But the truth changed her life. The truth, first of all, about who she is, that actually she is a woman, and that that's a good thing, not a bad thing. I mean, the number of girls that have been taught to hate themselves will be one of the greatest evils that we see in this generation. But then ultimately coming to the fact that her creator is the ultimate truth, the one who created her in his image and revealed himself in Jesus Christ. And that truth that she came to understand and embrace about who she is led to the ultimate truth about everything. And now she is this courageous defender of the truth. And what a wonderful promise for a generation like ours, where so many bad ideas have been swirling around, that repentance is possible, that change is possible, that we can reattach ourselves to truth. And she has become a courageous voice like few others in this time in which we live. So, I mean, there's other stories too. We tell Ayanna Hirsi Ali, Katie Faust, that truth telling is something, let me put it this way. George Orwell is famously credited for saying that in an age of deception, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. I think what it means to live in this time and place, a civilizational moment, we'll all find ourselves having to come face to face with the truth. And what will we do? Hopefully we will be able to know what's true, but then we're going to have to make that decision to commit ourselves to what is true. It doesn't mean we have to do it loudly and brashly and be a jerk, but it may cost us something. It may cost us a lot. We've seen events certainly in recent weeks where telling the truth is a profoundly consequential thing to do, but man, we can trust God with the results. And that's what really where Truth Rising lands.
John, I'm encouraged that in this documentary, you interview several people who stood for the truth. And in every one of those cases, they suffered, some more than others. Jack Phillips suffered. He was threatened with lawsuits, could have lost his business. I think of Chloe Cole, she suffered physically because she embraced bad ideas. I think of Katie Faust, she was blogging and she was bullied and threatened to be canceled.
And her whole church.
Absolutely. And so we see each of these people had the courage to stand for truth. And some have come to faith. Chloe Cole was an agnostic. She's come to faith. The Christian community embraced her, pointed her to the truth, loved on her. Same with Jack Phillips. He was encouraged. He was, even though not early on, but eventually he was encouraged and cheered on. But we see where when people stand, when especially Christians, when they stand and are willing to speak the truth, good can come from that. It's not comfortable, it's not easy, but good can come from that. John, I thought when I was going to watch this in Truth Rising, I thought I was going to read the passage from or hear about the passage from Romans chapter 1, verse 18, which speaks about the truth being suppressed. And we have truth that's suppressed in our culture. We have debanking. We have professional medical organizations endorsing gender transition of minors. We have cancel culture. It goes on and on. There's this suppression of truth. Romans 1:18 says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." And yet you share in this documentary what happens when people stand for truth. Mm-hmm. again, it's challenging, it's difficult, but good can come from that. And the most recent example, though, of standing for truth, and I think maybe one of the best examples in the last several years is Charlie Kirk, who would go on to college campuses, and he would essentially defend reality, defend the idea of truth, talk about male and female, people being made in the image of God, talk about the definition of marriage. And for that, he was shot mid-sentence. He was assassinated, which was ironic on a number of levels because, first of all, he did it on college campuses, which should be places of discourse in the free exchange of ideas. He did it with grace and compassion. He did not ridicule or belittle those on the other side, but he truly wanted to have a conversation and brought biblical truth, God's truth, into that public arena. John, my question is because of that assassination, are you concerned that this will intimidate Christians in particular or conservatives from engaging in the public arena? Do you think that more people are going to remain silent because of this horrible assassination?
Well, I hope not. I mean, it doesn't seem to be the case, you know, right now. We just had really in the wake of that horrific assassination, the single largest evangelistic event in all of human history take place in the form of the memorial service. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that every speaker, I think the president's comments were in stark contrast with the clear forgiveness that Erica Kirk offered. I think that the clear presentation of the gospel from Marco Rubio was just really amazing. I loved my friend Frank Turek's profound line that Charlie Kirk is in heaven, not because he sacrificed his life for Jesus, but because Jesus sacrificed his life for Charlie Kirk. What a powerful thing of truth telling that has come out of this. And I do think it's important to note that Romans 1 is really clear about how powerfully people can suppress the truth in their life. Mm-hmm. And that can happen on an individual level where people reach the point where they just deny reality up one side, down the other. That can happen on a cultural level, but truth is still truth. This is still God's world. It's like, you know, even in a culture that is really effective and really committed to suppressing the truth, you know, as somebody has put it, it's like trying to push beach balls under the water. They're still going to pop up everywhere. I think it's powerful that we have seen that in our cultural moment. Remember, we're all old enough here to remember the rise of the nuns, the N-O-N-E's, the people saying no, that, you know, that they were religiously unaffiliated. They didn't believe in any organized religion or God or anything like that. Now, the headlines are something completely different, which is young people are becoming more spiritual, more religious, more interested in spiritual things than any generation that we've seen in recent memory. Some of the same people that were, including in our film, The Truth Rising, that just a decade or two ago were saying that God's a delusion and religion is poisonous, are now saying we need Christianity. We need cultural Christianity. And some of them have started with cultural Christianity and ended with the full Christianity, which is obviously the truth about everything. So I have a lot of hope. And part of this is because the Bible tells us to have hope because Christ is risen from the dead. As my mentor, Chuck Colson, used to say, despair is a sin. It doesn't mean that we're not going to pay a price. We are going to pay a price. There is going to be a cost. Charlie's life and his death are, you know, key examples of that. But man, we can trust God in the process. We can trust that what he has told us is true is actually true. And if it's actually true, we can point to it. We can stand on it. We can do it with great confidence. And half the goal of Truth Rising is to address something that I think is a real crisis of confidence among Christians. You know, if somebody wants to come up and pick a fight with me about whether the earth is flat or round, I'm not going to get real worked up about it. I'm certainly not going to feel like intimidated to say my views about it because I have a good deal of confidence in it. So if the dominant response from Christians on some of these really important issues has been either to go silent or to just get irate, that tells you that there's a crisis of confidence. That's what I loved about how Charlie did what he did on college campuses. And I think he got better and better and better. You know, he got better at sticking on the issue. I think he got better at pointing underneath the question and revealing kind of the need of the heart, seeing the person as made in the image of God. All those things he got better at. And he did it with such a profound confidence that the truth is reliable. The truth is stable and that we can believe the truth, we can know the truth, we can love the truth, we can orient our lives around the truth, and again, leave the results up to God.
Yeah. John, I want to close with this from Flannery O'Connor. Some 80 years ago, she gave this advice to somebody she was corresponding with, and she said, push back against the age as hard as it pushes against you. Now, that was 80 years ago. She wasn't dealing with the issues that we're dealing with today, but it was a modernity that was encroaching on the Christian faith. But what do we do as Christians to push back? And I'm thinking that just the average person listening into this conversation, the mom, the dad, the single guy at work, the school teacher in the classroom, what are some practical things that we do to push back against the age? I think we sort of set this up. I think some of us look at Jack Phillips as some kind of a superhero and Chloe Cole as a superhero, but maybe that's not the case. What can regular people do?
Look, regular people, first of all, can understand that God has put them in this cultural moment too. So, I mean, here's the math of the Truth Rising Project. We live in a critical moment for Western civilization. It has everything to do with whether we embrace or abandon truth. And you are in this crazy civilizational moment because God wanted you here. So when you do all that math, the first is this idea of calling. I know that's kind of a big word, but I think it's as practical as it gets. Because we think about sometimes being called to a ministry or called to a job or called to an act of kindness at a certain time. We're also called to this moment. And that means our kids are as well. So if you're a parent, if you're a pastor, if you're a business leader and so on, this whole thing of taking a stand for truth when that decision, critical moments in front of you, this isn't just an issue for the superheroes, you know, to use your phrase. It's not for the professionals like Charlie. It's for all of us to get in the game. Yeah. And we may have that moment ourselves. And then the second question is if we are called to this moment and this moment looks like this, are we prepared? Have we equipped ourselves? I'm always struck by when I hear a young person say, well, you know, somebody challenged my faith and I didn't know what to say. I said, well, what challenge was it? And they bring up something that has been answered a million times in a million ways. Mm-hmm. And I think, man, we've got to get off this habit we have of saying that, you know, we shouldn't talk about this stuff in church, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
No, listen, take your faith seriously because your faith is built on what is true about life in the world. So take truth seriously, stand on it and live into this calling. Here's the goal. What if there were 100 more churches in America committed to truth than they are now? Yeah. Would that make a difference? I mean, what if there were 1,000 more people in Kentucky who understood the critical moment that we're in, and we're just willing when that moment comes to them to take that stand? I think it would be incredible. And I think that's what God's calling us to right now. So that's what the Truth Rising Project is all about.
John Stonestreet, thank you so much for putting this documentary together. Great resource. I strongly encourage those tuned in to check it out. Thank you for joining us on the Commonwealth Matters. God bless you, brother, and you keep up the good work.
Thank you. It's great to be on with you again.